Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Welcome to Profiling Evil's podcast by Mike King. I'm going to be interviewing Joseph Zimhart, a world-renowned mental health professional who specializes in cult information, intervention, and education. We'll be talking about exit strategies for those who have fallen prey to cult tactics. Recently, I was invited to talk about one of these destructive cults that I had investigated many years ago called the Zion Society on a podcast that's conducted by Joseph Zimhart. The podcast series Meet the Author is really intriguing, and I hope that you'll pay close attention and watch for that because there are some outstanding authors that he's talked to. Now, Joe's joined me today to explore the topic of cult exit strategies more deeply. And Joe, I just can't thank you enough for taking time to do so. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, I appreciate being here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, gosh, it's my privilege. I mean, you're a pro and an expert in this area. I'd like to, with your permission, tell everyone just a little bit about you. And then I wondered if you could maybe fill in some of your professional background, some of your unique experiences that you've had in the area of working with people in cults, and especially in some of the exit strategies that you have employed to help people exit cults. So, folks, let me just tell you a little bit about Joe. Joe is a mental health professional and a specialist in cult information, intervention, and education. Now, not only does he have decades of experience providing therapy to those who are exiting cults, he's backed up with an extensive education that ranges from undergraduate degrees like at the University of Dayton, Ohio, to his graduate degrees in fine arts and social psychology studies at Pennsylvania's Academy of Fine Arts, all the way to the University of New Mexico. I mean, Joe, you really have an interesting background from an academic perspective because sometimes folks just stick with one institution. And I think you've done it the way I always liked to see and I did in my own career. And that was to get an education experience from different kinds of universities.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Mike. Just to firm up my background, I have a Bachelor of Arts and Sciences from the University of Dayton and a Certificate of Accomplishment in Painting from the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. And I did do studies in social psychology at a university, but it was just a course or so. And I did a paper in that course on this topic of cults, which was unique because the teacher had not had anyone present that kind of a topic before. So with that academic stuff out of the background, essentially, I have training in the fine arts. And, in my work as a mental health professional, I was trained on the job. I've been doing it for 20 years at a psych hospital, which is crisis department work. And it's a multitasking, a variety of tasks that we do. We don't do multitasking. You can only do one task at a time. You know, that's something about the human creature. We don't concentrate on two things at once.
Well, so the thing that I am just so intrigued by and impressed with is number one, that you have that artistic side to you, and you have now this social medicine side of you, and I think that's really intriguing, and I know that you have been recognized as an expert all around the world. I mean, I don't know how many documentaries and news programs and shows that you've participated in, but the list is really exhaustive. But you know, the thing that I think is so impressive is the efforts that you're having today with things like Cult Education Institute or other organizations. Why have you seen your life kind of take this direction, do you think?
Bad luck. Was participating in what I now call cult-like organizations or groups back in the late 70s and into the end of 1980 or so. And I was a young artist when I moved out to New Mexico from Philadelphia. I was curious about something called theosophy, and I ran into some groups in Santa Fe that represented some aspect of theosophy. And one was the I Am movement. Another one was Church Universal and Triumphant, also called Summit Lighthouse. I started reading the literature of theosophy and that kind of thing, or what's called the occulture. It's something which is ignored mostly in universities because it's a fringe area of human interest, and it blends into religion and spirituality and metaphysics and all that stuff, alchemy, astrology, healing techniques that aren't scientifically approved or whatever. What got me curious about it is a lot of the modern artists that I was intrigued with had studied this kind of thing in the art culture. The Order of the Golden Dawn attracted people like William Butler Yeats and his wife. And some rather famous people have dabbled in the occult groups. A lot of our so-called secret societies fall into the art culture, like the Skull and Bone Society at Yale, for instance, and there's dozens and dozens of them. So when you start counting cults or estimating how many are out there, that number I've heard before, 3,000 to 5,000, has been bandied around since the 90s. No one can really count them because most of these groups, the vast majority, are quite small, family-sized, and they're under the radar, and they might be under a name which you wouldn't consider fringe or weird. You know, it could be a Family Values Organization, for instance, could be the name of a very tightly controlled group. So to understand cults, you have to understand what we mean by the word, and maybe we can get into defining that. So let me ask you this, you know, how do you define cult? How do you frame it, for instance, in what you've looked at so far? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just
appreciate it. And, you know, yeah, and the thing that I think is so exciting in talking to someone like you and bantering back and forth with someone like me is that my approach has always been from the investigative standpoint. And I'm going to be interested in how your approach has been, because you also had the opportunity of seeing the inside of a cult. But from the outside, my definition of a cult would be any group or philosophy that focuses on a leader, not the ideology, and that the leader becomes the central point of everything and every action that occurs in it, but particularly that it remains as a very subversive, hidden, secret kind of society. And I've seen things like polygamy be categorized as a cult. Well, there are polygamists that are generational in nature. They're very open about the fact that they believe in plural marriage. They are consenting adults that are doing it. They're not hiding anything. But then there's what I found to be a problem are these convert groups that kind of spring up, and they are based on not this is something that God wants us to do, but this is something God wants. And by the way, I'm God. And you're gonna follow everything that I have to say. So I guess I always look at it about, is it transparent or is it subversive in nature? And I guess that would be the starting point in answering your question. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's one. It's a valid way to define what we call a deceptive, destructive, or extreme group that we call cults, right? And I find that to be a good, useful starting point for the discussion. But let me broaden this out a little bit, because cults come in so many varieties that there's thousands of versions of this out there. So I'm going to do two things. You know, we'll look at an example and we'll look at my framework of how I define what's would be called a problematic cult. Not all cults are problematic. All right, so there has to be some kind of a transcendent attraction to the whole thing. So it could be the revelation that somebody had that they saw God and they start talking about it. It could be somebody that had a psychological awakening, like, for instance, The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle, for instance. And he has a kind of a cult following, you know, workshops and all of that based on this awareness that he had that everything is in the moment, you know, and he expanded on that. It's quite simplistic, but it works to attract thousands of people. Is it dangerous? Is it secretive? No. But it is a cult of an idea, and with this person who's not very charismatic at the center of it, and he, you know, and his behavior is basically benign. But you can call that a kind of a social cult. So the second thing is some kind of an authoritative leader. Now, I've mentioned Eckhart Tolle. He's considered authoritative. The people are kind of glued to him when they listen to him, right? So there's this charisma. Now, charisma is about relationship. It's not something that somebody has. You know, some people that are considered charismatic by their so-called cult following might be considered to be just an a-hole or someone that's disturbing to other people that aren't in the cult following. So charisma is about the relationship. It's not about the traits of the person. The third thing in cult formation is that there has to be some kind of circular tension. There has to be the outside and the inside. There has to be kind of movement around a central idea, usually with the leader, but sometimes there's no leader. Sometimes it's just an idea or an object at the center of this. And it becomes the main focus of the followers' lives. It's almost a 24/7 thought process going on that affects their behavior, what they read, what they watch on TV, you know, what the people they associate with, all of that. So there's an us and them circular movement around an idea or a person. The last thing, and this is the key, is the exit perils. What is it going to cost you to leave this circle of devotion?
Interesting.
That's where the problem comes in. Okay, mainly because in the average club or clan or benign gang or whatever you want to call these things, cult if you want to use the word, if you want to leave, they say, okay, you know, sign this paper, you're no longer a member of the club, you know, or just never come to meetings again. You know, the average lapsed Catholic will just stop going to church and never say anything, and they're gone, you know, and they explore stuff, and the church isn't going to. You know, there might be some condemnation in the dogma, but they're not going to chase after the person. They're not going to ruin their image in public, you know, and all of that, which is true of almost all major religions, you know, that are not fundamentalist. For instance, in fundamentalist Islam, if you become an infidel, you're subject to persecution and maybe even execution in that mindset. But that's not true of all of Islam.
Really good,
you know,
point.
Because I know a lot of Muslims that hardly practice religion. Yeah. So you have to look at the case in point, not the whole category of that particular religion. So the exit pearls, one professor, Benjamin Zablocki, who died in the last couple years, and I lectured with him a couple times, he saw brainwashing as what happens to a person when they think about leaving a group, not how they get in. You know, so once you get in, you learn all these things and you learn all these behaviors and all these ideas. But if you start doubting, if you start thinking about, you know, I got to get out of here. This isn't right. I feel confined. I feel like I'm in a straitjacket. I can't think clearly. These people are weird. There's going to be costs for that. You're going to lose your community. You might lose your investment. You might lose your sense of integrity. You know, now you've got to admit to people that knew you outside the group that this whole thing that you were in is BS. How are you going to talk about that? That's not easy. You know, it's like telling people you were in a mental institution. You don't want to talk about it, right? So getting away from a group is not easy. It's hard. It's easy to get in. It's hard to get out. So you notice the so-called brainwashing or the heavy influence when you think about leaving or when you're challenged to leave, like with me, an exit counselor. I show up by surprise. A family invites me. Their 30-year-old daughter is at home, and they just you know, decided to come home after getting into something like Scientology. And now their family wants them to talk to me. Of course, they don't want to talk to me. I represent a threat. but I have to quickly try to gain rapport with that person, show them it's safe to talk to me, and that if they want to stop talking to me, that's fine. But I have some things I think you want to hear, you know. So after a few days of conversation and sharing vital information, more than half the time the person would leave the group. But it takes about 30 hours of work and gentle give and take talk to do that kind of intervention. It's not a 1 hour thing. It's not a 1 hour a week thing. It means helping a person reorganize the way their synapses are working, the way the neural nets in their brain are connected together. This isn't easy. You know, it takes some skill and a lot of information background in order to accomplish that kind of intervention.
I want to invite our listeners to go back and just listen to the last 5 minutes, Joe, because I think it is so educational what you've just said. I've always looked at these cases a little differently. And now I'm thinking the exit strategy, I mean, that's brilliant, is how impactful is the exit strategy. And you know, we talked about the Zion Society case and how those children, it took them 15, 20 years to get past the fears of that exit strategy, what it meant to disown the group and disavow the group. This is, folks, I'm talking to Joe Zimhart. Joe is an expert in exit strategies for folks that have been involved in cults. He's been involved in therapy and giving and providing therapy to people who have exited cults for decades. He's an author. He's an educator on the cult subject of cults and cult dynamics. And I'm just so grateful that you're here with me today, Joe. So let's kind of pick up the conversation.
Let me just give a quick example of what we mean by cult in a sense of a historic example. We all know who Joan of Arc was, right? There's been movies done about her. You know, she lived centuries ago. Well, a young teenager, maiden, had a conversation with a tree spirit. These would talk to her. So there was a in those times in the pre-Christian cultures, tree spirits, talking trees were kind of common, or the idea of a tree as a functional energy form or something. The Garden of Eden had a tree cult involved in it, if you want to look at it that way. The tree of the life, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there was something associated with trees in human culture. So you can say some tribal systems have trees as their central focus point, you know. So there's Joan of Arc. She has hearing the voice of God, and she becomes this kind of a young hero and military leader in a war, 30 years war, and wins battles, has God guiding her. She's dressed in armor. She you know, the Maid of Orleans. Yet she's considered by the establishment toward the end of her life as a kind of a witch. She's in a cult in their mind, right? And they decide to execute her, and she's burned at the stake. You know, so who's calling who a cult here? And anyway, that same aspect of the church, which is only one aspect of it, that condemned her, later in the main began to revisit her story, and they created a saint out of her. Now she's a heroine. Now she's become what we might call a good, benign cult figure in the cult of saints in the Catholic Church, and is revered, you know, as a great saint. So this is part of the discussion here, is who's calling who a cult, and you have to look at the context. So you have to set up, like I did before with these four aspects, in order to frame what you're looking at, to get some idea, you know, is this dangerous? Is this constricting? You know, and how is it doing that? You have to ask a lot of questions before you begin labeling groups like this. So that's what I really want to
say. You know, you and I have talked about a mutual friend, Dr. Yanya Lelich, and a book that she joined with Margaret Singer on. The quote that I love and I've spoken about on many occasions is the fact that she says, people can be convinced to do almost anything, but it's a slow process to get them. If you told them from the get-go, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, But if you told them from the get-go what they were in for, they would never agree to that. So what is it that makes, because you describe some cult leaders as less than charismatic, but somehow they hook and pull. How are they doing it?
Well, again, it's the transcendent attraction, and that happens in thousands of ways. One of the groups where they rarely met the leader was run by a guy named Jim Roberts. He began it in the early 1970s. He was a young preacher. He was also a former Marine, and he had a very almost schizoid way of approaching people. He, you know, very shy in a sense, but he could also be very forceful when he talked about the Bible and his fundamentalist version of it, which was I call primitive Christianity. He was what we might call in constitutional law an originalist. He believed he was teaching the original Christianity, the way they lived it. So all of his followers, the men and women, began to dress in modest clothes, like the men wore tunics to cover their lower parts, and the women wore long ankle length dresses, you know. So they looked a little bit like old Puritans. The men had long beards and short hair because this is how they imagined the primitive Jews to dress. They didn't have long hair. Jesus didn't have long hair in their view. He had a beard and short hair. So there was a conformity in the group. Jim ran the group. He had like maybe 100, 150 members maximum at any time in cells. There were 10 or 20 or 5 around the country. Somebody would go to a payphone, would call where they knew the number he would be, and he would tell them what to do, mostly by payphone.
Yeah,
this is way well before the internet. And they were well organized. And they, like I said, they didn't see him very often. Sometimes he would show up at camp meetings. They lived off the land, basically. They camped out a lot. They lived in abandoned homes. But, they did what was called dumpster diving, getting free food from places. They lived pretty well, considering. They all had bicycles. They knew how to fix bicycles. But what I'm bringing up here is the leader, if you met him, would be very shy. He wouldn't want to talk to you. He didn't preach openly. He didn't debate in public. He wouldn't have never appeared in social media. So there's different kinds of leaders. There's different kinds of ideas. So basically, he was selling an idea that this is what Christ really taught. This is how primitive Christians lived. And people bought into the idea, and he just kept manipulating it, basically. And he kind of also chose who could get married, who could not, who was in the group, who wasn't. He would have people abandoned. They wouldn't know they weren't in the group. They would just be abandoned. So groups operate very differently, and you have to study each one individually. You can create a framework or a model for it, but you're going to find a group that breaks the model every time and still has this constricting kind of behavior that we're worried about. So basically, we're worried about constriction, psychological closure. If that's happening to a person, then you have a problem. Then they're not free to think.
That is really spooky when you think about it in that way. And I wanted to just ask you, and I have my own opinions on this, but who is more dangerous, the voice or the arm? And I say that in the person who's bringing out all of these revelations that they've come up with, or that devotee who wants to prove their allegiance to the leader. Who's more dangerous to us?
I think it's about the relationship, the danger in the relationship, because if the members perceive that they have this hero figure that's transcending human dimensions, they're above and beyond what we can do, and because of their connection to God or connection to some kind of transcendent knowledge. The leader is also dependent on the reaction of the followers. So sometimes you see politicians doing this. If they're on the campaign trail and they come up with some idea, about their plank, and they see the crowd reacting to it, they'll increase the volume about that particular thing in the next campaign in order to use it as a thing. We just saw our last president use that with the Great Wall. He didn't know that was a thing until he started talking about it. And then it became the thing, So the feedback from the devotees can also influence the leader. And there's kind of a feedback loop, so the leader has to dance to the needs of the followers. Now, if something really angers the leader, and he gets the followers all, you know, excited about it. Let's say it's a Muslim cleric who doesn't like Salman Rushdie's book, and he puts out a fatwa. Well, suddenly all these devotees are going to be looking for Salman Rushdie, and they're going to want to execute him. So the guy has to hide for years. You know, that's one way to look at this. You know, a leader can strike a match and create a forest fire. So that's kind of how that works, but it has to work in tandem. The followers also can feed the leader with ideas. It's interesting.
Yeah, that is amazing. So when you think about even some of the things that we've seen recently and the responsibility anyone that's in a leadership position has to speak responsibly, because folks might interpret that as marching orders to go do something that's really dangerous, that impacts all of us. I mean, there's such responsibility on leaders. And as you talk about these leaders, what is it that you find is a characteristic in their personality that makes them think that they somehow are endowed with this greatness?
Yeah, you know, we all have a kind of narcissism in us. We need it. You know, we need to believe that we're a little better than the next guy trying to get the job. And we present ourselves that way when we go for a job interview. So narcissism in human beings is natural, and it's not necessarily bad, but it can become a disorder if we overly invest in this imagined self, and that we call that grandiosity. And I think that that's one of the primary characteristics of a lot of cult leaders, that they become very grandiose. They like the feedback they're getting from their audience, and they feed it back to the audience to get more of it. Anybody that doesn't agree with the narcissistic definition of who the leader says they are is now on the outs and is condemned. You know, so, you know, if some guru from India has this image that he's enlightened somehow because of his knowledge of Siddha powers or the culture or whatever, and he has this kind of magic about him in terms of knowledge, he's going to condemn the people that don't believe in that as being unenlightened, ignorant, don't pay attention to them. You know, they're just disgruntled ex-members if they're complaining about what I did. They don't get it. You know, that kind of language comes out. So it and again, when anyone sets themselves up in this grandiose fashion, they're setting themselves up as a target also. So they have the in crowd, which is wants them to be grandiose because it makes them feel better to have a hero that they can follow. And you have outsiders criticizing the faults of the so-called hero. And then you end up with this tension in society. So cults tend to cause tension depending on their makeup and how big they are and how much influence they have with the society around them. That's one of the hallmarks of cult behavior. I mean, we saw the early Latter-day Saints. They had a difficult time marching across the country. They were vilified. They were persecuted, maybe for good reason. You know, they became a political force. They could take over a town by voting, and people around there didn't like that, you know. So it's a lot of, again, depending on which perspective you're looking at it from, whether you see it as a dangerous cult or as causing tension in society, and so forth. The early Christians were persecuted for similar reasons. And, you know, a lot of modern cults use that as an example. Well, Jesus was persecuted too. Look at what you're doing to our cult leader. You know, because but that would be called equivocation or a false analogy in most cases.
It seems to me like transparency is the key, because all of those groups, they initially start out with a feeling like the Latter-day Saints in Missouri, where they were being persecuted, and there was a lack of transparency and a lack of just a responsibility among people to be accepting and understanding. And we see it today. We see it over the years with challenges in race relationships in our country and frankly around the world, where we see it when it comes to religious persecution because of beliefs. And for some reason, we as a people be very inclusive. And I think that helps create cults, don't you?
I think so. You know, these groups form for different reasons. And like I said, there's many varieties of them that show up. So, you know, obviously society is not perfect and some people are more anxious in society. They're misfits and they want to do something to change it. And they have a revelation or some idea and start forming some people around themselves and which isn't bad, you know, to challenge things that are wrong in society is the American way. It's the way of democracies. It's the way of a lot of healthy societies. But these things, these movements can get out of hand. And that's where they become more constricting and close systems and refuse to accept criticism. That's when they go over the edge, is when there's no moderating influences. And they believe that their way is the only way, and anything else needs to be ignored or even destroyed. So, you know, these movements, you can look at Nazism, for instance. Germany was devastated after World War I, and it was primed for something to pull it together again. And there's this little guy, Hitler, that, you know, was kind of a low-level soldier imprisoned, writes Mein Kampf, and starts talking and gathering crowds. And he had the kind of pathological mind to be able to maneuver into power. But it started with essentially almost nothing. And he, you know, who the hell knew who he was when he started out?
So I want to see if there's a way to give some hope to people. And I want to start with family members that are watching a loved one who's getting sucked into this thing that they don't understand as a family member. They see it as being unhealthy. They see the loved one closing off. What can a family member do that watches a loved one getting sucked into a cult?
Well, number one, try not to show them information against the group right away. You know, like sending them email with a link to a YouTube talk by an ex-member. That's probably not going to work unless the person you're trying to reach is already asking some questions. Interesting. So the best thing to do at first is to just stay in touch with them, listen to them, see how they talk about their openness to the group and what they're learning. So kind of like a detective, you're going to gather information first, see what you have, you know, see how deep they're in, see what books they're reading, what they think about the leader, try to sort out whether they're having any, if there's any secrets involved, because a lot of these groups will tell the family, don't tell them who the leader is, because people don't understand our leader. You have to be more enlightened to grasp who he is. You know, so very often the recruiters won't even tell the members the recruitees who the leader is for a long time. They want them to get, see if they like the ideas, get them to bond and like the people recruiting them. You know, so once you've gotten someone into that first stage of compliance, they're in a process of choosing to get in slow steps. Now they're being misguided. They don't know that. But they've kind of come into a state of compliance. And once a human being does that, they begin telling themselves, I'm not a stupid person and I don't do stupid things. I'll know when to pull out, you know, and I did that myself. I can look back, you know, 30, 40 years ago and see myself doing that same process. You know, I'm smart. I have a college degree. I'll know when it's wrong. Well, I didn't. You know, I was rationalizing and justifying everything that now I consider wrong or deceptive or just a falsehood. So back to the family member trying to influence them, stay in rapport, gather information, find out how deep they're in, get help from someone else, talk to ex-members. But don't try to get them out. you cannot get somebody out of a cult. They have to choose their way out. They have to have information that they trust, and they have to be able to go through the process of you know, what we call prefrontal cortex decision-making, the management part of our brain, in order to weigh things, process them, sleep on them, see if it's right or wrong, and then start making painful decisions, you know, by saying, I was wrong about that.
That is a painful decision for someone to openly admit, I chose poorly.
We all go through that.
Do.
You know, that's not just
yes, we do. So I love the idea of maintaining and continuing the relationship. Often in these cults, part of the cult dynamic is the isolation from anyone that doesn't believe in the philosophy. So then that relationship gets cut off. Is this a place where people should just try to, as family members, show up at places they work or other things just to kind of keep reminding them of their past?
Yeah, that's been done by dozens and dozens of my clients in the past, where they've tried to, you know, the person's cut them off for months. There's no contact, and they find out where they are, maybe through a private detective, and then they decide to go knock on the house where they live and show themselves. Invariably, they get turned away. And then the cult member will tell their mother and father, I'm going to get a protection from abuse. I don't want you anywhere near me. You know, so that strategy can often backfire where there's no conversation whatsoever. Now, I've tried to guide families in that type of approach because that's all they have. You know, there's no way to get me in to talk to them. The person is so isolated and so turned against the darkness of the family or whatever that they refuse for months or even years to meet with the family members. So, you know, I would, in those cases, try to coach the family on how to talk to them if they happen to meet them, you know, how not to trigger them to create hate. And so sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But at times they might get a couple of hours of conversation, you know, with the leaders or manager of the group in the back room with them. And when it turns uncomfortable, they have to leave. But at least they have something, you know, they know that the person's healthy or unhealthy. They know that there is a functional person inside of that cult veneer and all of that. And maybe they can make an agreement, you know, listen, we're not going to try to get you out of the group. We want to respect you. We might not understand or grasp what you're doing. You know, we want to put this cult conversation behind us. We want to continue a relationship with you, you know, and then there has to be some hypocrisy involved. They have to bite their tongue when they do meet with that person again, briefly, maybe a month later, they have lunch and they can't tell them exactly what they think about the group, because what do you want? Do you want an argument or do you want a relationship with the person? That's the question you have to ask yourself. So the relationship with the person is more important over the long time. And actually, it can help that person leave the group because they notice that the family isn't that bad. They're willing to let me do this, you know, without getting in my face or arguing with me about it. And they're not as bad as the group is saying parents are or families are or outsiders are. So, you know, it's a game, you know, but it's an important game. As Wittgenstein said, we know we all set up these language games. And we have to be careful how we do it in order to have a conversation, in order to have meaning and understanding. And so, you know, family isn't necessarily being hypocritical by not criticizing the group in conversation. They're being wise and they're trying to maintain rapport with someone they love who they believe at some point will leave the group.
I'll tell you, it's interesting to me. Every time we talk, Joe, I feel like I'm sitting in a classroom. I love the exchange, and I get so frustrated because the time seems to just fly by. And so first and foremost, I've got to have you back. But I wondered if you could maybe tell folks where they could learn more, what websites you would suggest that they visit. And then I just want to spend a minute and talk about your books, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. The book is this one here. Santa Fe, Bill Tate and me, you know, and how an artist became a cult interventionist. And it came out just the last year. So it tells my story. It also gives, you know, the same things I've been talking to you about interventions. I have lots of examples in here, some that failed, some that worked out, some which were extraordinary that they worked out at all. And how I frame what a cult is based on my reading of a lot of other experts. And so I don't take credit for coming up with a model. I just reworked it to make it more useful when I give lectures.
Well, I not only love the title, Santa Fe, Bill Tate and Me, How an Artist Becomes a Cult Interventionalist, but it really tells a piece of your story. And it helps explain this incredible dynamic of cult relationships. Thank you so much, Joe. Folks, make sure you go to Amazon and check out the book, Santa Fe, Bill Tate and Me, How an Artist Became a Cult Interventionalist. And this is going to be a great read. I am going to be buying it today. I just am so excited to have you on, Joe. Will you please come back?
Yeah, certainly. Just let me know. Give me about a week's notice and we can do it.
That'll be great. And I hope that you know, Joe, how much I appreciate you taking time. To the entire Profiling Evil family who's listening, again, please get out and look at his book and purchase it if it makes sense to you. And for everyone out there, if you ever feel uncomfortable in a situation that you're in, talk with family, talk with your mental health or your medical provider, or contact your local police department and get help. Most often, these situations where you feel uncomfortable don't get better without some form of intervention. Until we have a chance to meet again, I hope that you'll hit the subscribe button and make sure you're getting notifications and make sure that you continue to follow us here at Profiling Evil. And Joe, my sincere thanks to you, not only as a friend, but as a colleague in this great work.
All right, great, Mike. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good talking to you.
Thanks for listening to the Profiling Evil podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And please, don't forget to go to our YouTube channel where you can watch some of the hundreds of videos we've created. Now, if you're looking for a great crime story, check out my new book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. You can find it at profilingevil.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for our elite newsletter, The Bolo. I'm Mike King, and thanks for listening. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.